From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Tuesday edition, earlier this afternoon, President Biden said there is no evidence of Russian de-escalation in Ukraine.
Our analysts indicate that they remain very much in a threatening position. And the fact remains, right now, Russia has more than 150,000 troops encircling Ukraine and Belarus and along Ukraine's border. An invasion remains distinctly possible.
We'll talk with Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And how deep is the deep state? Is anyone safe? Those are just some of the questions being asked after last Friday's court filing by Special Counsel John Durham. According to the special counsel's latest court filings, individuals working for Hillary Clinton and her campaign not only spied on candidate Donald Trump, but gained access to internet traffic pertaining to the executive office of the President of the United States. Where might this investigation lead? We'll talk about that as well with Senator Blackburn, who serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee as well. And too little too late, Washington, D.C. Mayor Bowser has apparently awakened to the reality that she was moving in the opposite direction from the sane world. The mayor has lifted the vaccine passports and the mask mandates for most indoor venues. But the cumulative effect of her mismanagement of the federal city has become a major issue with congressional Republicans. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy has said when Republicans gain a congressional majority, they will hold the D.C. government accountable for everything from COVID overreach to record-setting homicides to pervasive homelessness. Kentucky Congressman James Comer, ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, the congressional committee that has jurisdiction over D.C. government, joins us a little later here on Washington Watch. In our Olympics 2022 Human Rights on Ice segment, we'll be joined by FRC's Mary Sock as we look at how China's restrictive one-child policy that led to millions of abortions and abandoned children has morphed into a three-child policy. Now, does this suggest the regime is reforming? We'll talk about it a little later here on Washington Watch. And remember this.
12 years is no longer enough today to compete with the rest of the world in the 21st century. That's why my American Families Plan guarantees 4 additional years of public education for every person in America, starting as early as we can.
That was President Biden in April of last year in a speech before Congress announcing yet another one of his trillion-dollar spending plans. This one, early childhood education. Is this a good idea or a bad idea? We can find the answer in a new longitudinal study out of Tennessee on academic preschool programs. We'll talk with Dr. Catherine Stevens from the Center on Child and Family Policy. The website, TonyPerkins.com. The entire program is archived there. You can watch it later if you miss anything. You can also share it with your friends. From today's Stand on the Word, our 2-year Bible reading plan, we highlight Exodus chapter 20, verse 24. In every place where I cause my name to be remembered, the Lord said, I will come to you and I will bless you. There is power in the name of the Lord. May we not go silent nor shrink back from proclaiming the name of Jesus. As the psalmist wrote in Psalm 44:5, through you we will push down our foes. Through your name we tread down those who rise up against us. To find out more about the Bible reading plan, go to frc.org/Bible. And just a reminder, you can join me each morning at 8:44 a.m. Eastern Time on my Facebook page, or you can go to TonyPerkins.com for a daily devotion from our passage of the day. In October of 2020, then U.S. Attorney General William Barr appointed Attorney John Durham to serve as DOJ's special counsel to continue his investigation into matters related to the 2016 presidential campaigns, in particular, the origins of the Trump-Russia collusion probe. Well, last Friday night, Durham filed his latest set of charges claiming that a tech executive with ties to the Clinton campaign exploited his access to non-public and/or proprietary internet data and tasked researchers at a U.S.-based university to, quote, mine internet data to establish an inference and narrative tying then-candidate Trump to Russia, end quote. Durham claims that the executive indicated that he was seeking to please certain VIPs, which included individuals at the Clinton campaign. Well, despite this, legacy media is shrugging off the special counsel's latest filings. Why are they? But why shouldn't they? Well, with me now to talk about this and more is Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee, who serves on four Senate committees, including Senate Judiciary Committee and the Armed Services Committee. Senator Blackburn, welcome back to the program.
Good to join you. Thank you so much. And thanks for talking about the Durham report. Kind of amazing that the mainstream media has chosen not to talk about this at all.
Well, not really. They want to sweep this under the rug. But before we get into more evidence, I believe, of a deep state, President Biden announced about 2 hours ago that the U.S. has no evidence that a Russian move to de-escalate is underway in Ukraine. What do you know about that?
What we know is that Russia has continued to menace there along the Ukraine border. We have been disappointed that the president did not move forward in the fall with sanctions, with sales of lethal assistance to the Ukrainian army so that they could defend themselves. We've been disappointed that there was not a comprehensive and unified messaging coming from the diplomatic side of these negotiations. And we are pleased that the administration has finally stepped up. But Tony, as you well know, when it comes to this type activity by our adversaries, you can't sit around and wait. You have to be proactive in what you're going to do and go ahead with sanctions, go ahead with these sales to let them know you're not taking this lightly. And unfortunately, the action coming from the Biden administration is more reactive. It is now postured as if you do this, then there will be no Nord Stream 2. That could have been done last fall so that the buildup never occurred.
It's a really good point, Senator Blackburn, because not only is it the Biden administration, but Democrats, primarily in the Senate. You know, 2 weeks ago, we heard that there was a bill working its way through for sanctions. Obviously, there was a disagreement over whether the sanctions should be proactive, as you've described, or reactive, as the tendency is. We have nothing. So we're going to wait to see what Russia does. So actually, we're sitting on the sidelines doing absolutely nothing to prevent this invasion of Ukraine.
That's right. It is the lead from behind strategy that the Obama presidency exercised, and now Biden is doing likewise. Now, Senator Jim Risch has legislation, which is the proactive approach on sanctions that we as Republicans would take. But here's one of the points that I think is so important for all of us to remember. You did not see our adversaries coming at us with President Donald Trump because they knew what he was going to do. He told them what he would do if they took an action. So they didn't do it. And it is important that we pay attention to that, and that people use this time to look at it and see what a difference there is. You can look at Afghanistan, where the withdrawal under Biden was a debacle. Prior to that, 18 months, we did not lose any of our troops in Afghanistan. And then with the withdrawal and Biden in charge, 13 on one day because of the inconsistencies and the debacle that was there over that withdrawal.
Well, Senator Blackburn, I am grateful. You're one of those that does not lead from behind at all. You are out front. And one of the issues you've been raising even before you got into the Senate, but in particular, as we've seen in the last few years, the deep state. What do you make of the latest filings of the special counsel?
What we know from General Durham's filings are this. That this alleged link between the Clinton campaign through Sussman, a top DNC lawyer, Mark Elias, Jake Sullivan, getting the tech exec who has now been identified, the company has been identified. There appears to be substance to this. I think what we see is the Durham investigation is moving into a new phase where they are identifying the specifics that transpired. And Tony, we have to remember, the Trump campaign was being run out of Trump Tower. The Trump transition was being run out of Trump Tower. I vice chaired that transition. When we got all of this information on allegations and surveillance, I wrote to DOJ. I said, was I being surveilled during this period of time? I never got a response. But I think what we will be able to find out is how far and how deep did this web go? Who all was involved? Who all were they surveilling? How much information did they pull from any of us, that any individuals that were working there in Trump Tower? Did they gather information on people that were not a part of the Trump campaign, but were residents in that tower? What have they done with that information? There are a lot of questions now that are coming into focus because of the work that John Durham is doing and what he has found out. I will tell you this. Jake Sullivan is who was Hillary's campaign lead at that point and who broke the news of all of this Russia collusion is now President Biden's national security director. He should step down.
You know, we have seen this kind of stuff. I mean, we saw it through the entire Trump administration, you know, the whole Russian collusion hoax and all of this. If the Republicans are able to retake the Congress in the next election, the midterm election, you know, people have been asking, when will folks be held accountable? And I know Durham's doing his investigation, and it's slow and methodical, but I hope it does lead to some resolution. But Congress has oversight. Do you think, I mean, you're a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Can we expect to see something out of the Senate?
Indeed, we can. And yes, Durham is slow and methodical. He's already had indictments and prosecutions. There will be more to come. And of course, it is important for the Senate to conduct their oversight. We have to bear in mind that the Senate cannot indict anybody. They cannot try anybody. All of that is going to come through DOJ. And General Durham is going to continue with his investigation and bringing all of this forward.
Well, I know there are a lot of folks waiting for that day because we've seen, you know, so much duplicity. Yeah. And, you know, you have certain individuals that were charged with crimes, their reputations and their lives ruined, while others just seem to get off scot-free, who are actually guilty of things, or at least appear to be.
Yes, and that is something. At church on Sunday, I had someone bring up this very point. They said, you know, going back into the Clinton years, when the Clintons were in the White House, there seemed to develop a two-tier standard of justice. Right. And different people were treated different ways, and they're ready for it to end.
You're absolutely right, Senator. I know you'll stay on this as well. Senator Marsha Blackburn, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You got it. Take care.
All right. Folks, stick with us. Coming up, the D.C. mayor announced yesterday she will allow her public health emergency declaration to expire today. No more vaccine passports and masks in D.C. But it's not enough. We'll talk more after the break.
Are you struggling to spend consistent time in God's Word? Then join Family Research Council on an exciting journey through the Bible. FRC's two-year Bible reading plan helps you to approach daily Bible reading with an intentional focus of diving deeper into the nature of God and how His Word speaks into cultural issues. By studying the Bible, we can see the grandeur of God unfold throughout the past. The Stand on the Word reading plan takes you through daily scripture in an engaging manner to help you stay grounded in God's truth. All wisdom comes from God, and He has given us the Bible as a way to understand the world. Start this adventure today with Family Research Council. When you sign up, we'll text you every Sunday with daily passages and questions that help prepare you for conversations with your friends and family. To begin this journey, visit frc.org/Bible. With the current division and confusion of our culture, it is so important for Christians to root ourselves in the truth of God's Word so that we are prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have. For this purpose, Family Research Council launched the Center for Biblical Worldview. The center applies the Bible and the historical teachings of the church to current issues. This helps Christians understand and live by a biblical worldview, know why Scripture must be authoritative, and equips believers to advance and defend the faith in workplaces, schools, communities, and the public square. The experts at the center address and provide resources on issues like religious liberty, abortion, voting, marriage, and sexuality. To access free resources like the Biblical Worldview series, go to frc.org/worldview. To get highlights of the latest work of the Worldview Fellows, including blogs, interviews, and publications, sign up at frc.org/subscriptions.
At Family Research Council, it is important to us that we stay connected with you and that you stay informed. With the increase in tech censorship of conservatives and Christians, we've decided to be proactive to make sure we don't go completely dark due to censorship. That is why we've created a tech subscription platform. If we get canceled, you can stay informed and still find updates on faith, family, and freedom. How? Just text STAND to 67742 to sign up for our text alerts, and you will get FRC's content straight to your phone. Again, just text STAND to 67742, and you will get special alerts on the biggest stories of the day. You can stay informed with just a simple text. We want you to be able to stay connected with like-minded community and to always have access to our content. Stay connected and informed. Just text STAND to 67742.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So good to have you with us. Thanks for tuning in. And let me encourage you, invite a friend to watch Washington Watch as well. All right, House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy and Republicans on the House Oversight Committee want to hold D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser accountable for abusing the levers of power during the pandemic and implementing policies that they believe are hurting the nation's capital. And I can attest to that. In a response, Mayor Bowser announced yesterday that she will allow her public health emergency declaration to expire today, which means no more vaccine passports, which was killing local restaurants, small businesses. Also, certain jurisdictions won't have to have masks in their buildings. Well, we never had them anyway. They were voluntary. But is this too little too late? Joining me now to talk about this is U.S. Congressman James Comer. He's the ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, which is the committee that has jurisdiction over the District of Columbia. He represents the 1st Congressional District of Kentucky. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, let's talk about the mayor's announcement yesterday. Is this reactionary? Is she finally seeing that she's moving in the opposite direction of the sane world?
Well, I think she's following the political science. That's what we've said all along, and they're just a little late to the curve. And what they've realized, in my opinion, the Democrat mayors have got a fresh batch of polling in that shows that even liberal Democrats are sick and tired of their mandates. They're sick and tired of wearing masks everywhere, having to whip out vaccine cards. Now, and then some hotels and restaurants were going a step further, saying you had to have a vaccine passport as well as a booster card. And it's just too much for the businesses. Every business realized that they're seeing a huge decline in their customer base. The airlines, every member of Congress will tell you, over the last 3 months, we're getting back to pandemic-level attendance on these airlines because people are just saying, I'm not going to Washington, D.C. And it's not just the mandate. It's the crime in Washington, D.C. Yeah. And this affects Congress because we want our constituents to come to Washington, and we want them to feel safe. Washington, D.C. should be the model of democracy, but it's not. You go to Washington, D.C., crime is up, homicides are up. Shoplifting's up. Carjacking's up. You're seeing more tent cities all over Washington, D.C. You can't take a cab from the airport to anywhere in Washington, D.C. without seeing all these homeless people and crimes and businesses boarded up. And enough is enough. And we're just trying to hold the mayor accountable. And I hope that we don't have to do it legislatively, but we're asking her to come before the Oversight Committee and explain to us what her plan is to reduce crime, to open businesses back up, and to get people to feel comfortable coming back to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I see it every time I fly in and drive into the office. I mean, I was commenting to one of my members of the staff the other day. It reminded me of being in a third world country where under every overpass, you've got these tent cities and such. But let me step back for just a second, Congressman. A little history lesson here of civics. The fact that Congress, you know, the District of Columbia is a federal city. And up until, I think, 1973, Congress basically governed the city. Now, they have home rule charter where they're able to do their own thing. But it's not been working out. What might we expect in the in a new Congress that might be led by Republicans?
Well, we're going to expect to see Mayor Bowser be asked to come before the committee. And if she refuses to come, then, you know, we have subpoena power. Surely to goodness, it won't come to that. The House of Representatives, specifically the House Oversight Committee, is supposed to be the check and balance over Washington, D.C. And prior to 73, Congress made most of the decisions for Washington, D.C. That changed, and, you know, it's worked out fairly well, I guess, up until here in the last decade, and especially in the last two or three years, crimes escalate, businesses are in decline. People aren't feeling comfortable or welcome to come to their nation's capital to petition their government. That's a constitutional right of every American. But when you put it to where there's so many obstacles and rules and regulations to come to Washington, D.C., and then add to that the one of the highest crime rates in the world, then you've got a situation to where somebody's got to step in and hold this mayor accountable. She's had policies of excessive criminal justice reform, bail reform. You have prosecutors who are not prosecuting. They're woke. They're not prosecuting. They're not doing their job. They've defunded the police. They've put every kind of gun control you can possibly put on a city in place. And as a result, you're seeing escalating crime with no end in sight.
And not to mention that the federal government pays a large part of the bill for the federal city. So there should be some voice into how the city's governed.
There is. You know, we're going to have a lot of opportunity, hopefully, in a majority, in a Republican majority, to enact a lot of reforms. I hate to have to waste time calling the mayor to come in to try to figure out how we solve the mess that she's created. But unfortunately, it's going to come to that. And that's going to be just something else that's going to be on our platter. We're going to give her an opportunity. I want her to be successful. I want Washington, D.C. to be a model city, a model for democracy. I want the planes to be full and the restaurants to be full and the hotels to be full. But what we've seen is a decline. And even when other cities have gone back to business as usual, even some of the Democrat cities that had pretty strict rules and regulations in place during the pandemic, Washington, D.C. has doubled down. They, you know, still up until this week, mask mandates, vaccine passports, children, even today, still have to wear masks. And you've got a school system that's not the model of public education in America in Washington, D.C., and the masks is only making it worse. The virtual learning only made it worse. So this is a city that is poorly run. Congress does have oversight over it. We're going to use our oversight. We're going to try to work with her to see that she can work with the local elected officials to turn things around. If not, then Congress is going to hold her accountable and try to make some decisions for her. And it's unfortunate to get like that. I'm for local control. I don't want to be a nanny committee, but, you know, it's not working out there. And it's just there's no end in sight to the problems in Washington, D.C.
Congressman, Congressman Comer, I can say, as one who spends an awful lot of time in D.C., I am thankful that that day is coming where we can have some oversight. Congressman, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming on today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, stick around. We're coming back after the break with our special segment, Human Rights on Ice. Don't miss it.
What is religious liberty and why should you care about it? Simply put, religious liberty is the freedom to choose your religious beliefs and to live according to those beliefs. Why should we care about this freedom? At Family Research Council, we care about religious freedom because we believe that it is an inherent human right that all governments have an obligation to protect. Tragically, not all governments do. Religious persecution is a tragic reality around the world that is not often acknowledged by the media, even though attacks on people of all faiths continue to increase globally. In Scripture, God calls Christians to pray and care for the persecuted church, the downtrodden, and those who cannot help themselves. Therefore, we must be advocates for those persecuted for their faith. To access Family Research Council's latest resources and to learn more about religious freedom and what you can do to help the persecuted, go to frc.org/religious liberty.
Do you want to be able to stay up to date on conservative news? Are you looking for Christian resources to help you stay politically engaged? Then download Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. With all of our content available at your fingertips, you will conveniently be able to stay up to date throughout your busy day. The Stand Firm app will give you access to a variety of resources, such as our most recent episodes of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, tweets and other social media posts, and our latest blogs, updates, and publications. Additionally, you will have the opportunity to take action and make your voice heard by contacting your elected officials on the issues that most concern you. Visit the App Store on your smartphone or mobile device and search Stand Firm to download Family Research Council's official Stand Firm app.
Beijing 2022, Human Rights on Ice.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. As the Olympics take place in Beijing, we've been focusing a segment each day on the repressive nature of that communist regime and their abuse of human rights. China's restrictive one-child policy led to millions of abortions and abandoned children, but it's morphed into a three-child policy. Now, does that suggest that the regime has changed its view on the value of human life? Joining me now is FRC's Mary Sock. She's the director of our Center for Human Dignity. Mary, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony.
So let me put that question to you, Mary. We went from this one-child policy, which lasted for decades. Now they've morphed into a three-child policy. Did they somehow see the light and the value of human life?
Unfortunately, no. When China began their one-child policy in the late 1970s, early 1980s, what we saw was a lot of propaganda about how, you know, only having one child would make China a prosperous and powerful nation. Well, what China has realized is that a nation without people is without children is a nation without hope. And there's not hope for the future in China. They've seen all sorts of unintended and unexpected side effects there, such as an increased suicide rate among elderly members of their society. They've seen an increased infertility rate among child age bearing women, and they've seen, as we expected, their population has declined. The Chinese Communist Party sees people as a tool to serve the government. They believe that people were created to serve them instead of to serve God. And their expansion to a three-child policy is no more than another attempt to use people as a tool to serve the government.
Now, Mary, I'm tempted to say, you know, how could you miss this when you go to a one-child policy and it led to sex selection abortions, where we saw families that would abort girls because they wanted boys, especially in the rural areas of China, because they work and they can provide income. All of a sudden, you have this imbalance between male and female. I mean, you would think, oh, we could see that as plain as day. But, you know, we have to realize first, you know, America has done a lot of the same things with our embracing of unrestrained abortion all the way through the ninth month of pregnancy. We are suffering from these, I would say, unintended consequences. I'm not sure that they're unintended by everybody, but certainly by most. So, you know, we got to be careful about criticizing China on this point, because in some ways, you know, our policies have gotten worse in the times that we've been challenging China on their one-child policy.
They actually have. And you point out an interesting fact, Tony, which is that in China, actually, since 2001, sex selective abortion has been illegal there. And it is because of the number of baby girls that have been killed since the one child policy was instituted. In the United States, there is no national law protecting life of any sort in the womb. And while, of course, we know that the motives of China behind this are not that they believe in the dignity of every little baby girl in the womb, we know that their motives are to serve their government. But here in the United States, we need to be very cautious pointing the finger at China, because we certainly can see here that we have allowed our culture to do the same thing that the Chinese government has done. We have allowed our culture to tell women, if you don't have children, you will be prosperous. If you don't have children, you will advance your career. If you don't have children, you will succeed. That's what the Chinese government has said since the 1980s. And that's what American culture has said since 1973.
Well, it goes back to a utilitarian view of human beings that, as you said, they're there to serve the Chinese Communist Party. Well, you know, while we don't have a Communist Party leading America, you know, you see the same arguments when they embrace this whole green agenda that somehow children consume our limited resources. Therefore, if you have more than one or two, you're being irresponsible here in this country. So it's getting away from that understanding that every child is created in the image of God, and therefore they have inherent value and they should be welcomed into the world and protected under our laws. I would argue, Mary, that in this area, because we've embraced China as an economic partner, once again, we see an area where America has been more influenced by China than we have influenced China.
Absolutely, Tony. And one thing that Americans should recognize is that abortion was first legalized by a communist country of Russia. That was the first place where legal abortion took place. And it was used as a tool to dismantle the family. It was used as a tool to give the government control. Here in the United States, when we tell families how many children that they should be having, and when we try to make the family serve the economy instead of the other way around, as President Biden has tried so hard to make sure that we have mothers in the workforce, because mothers have to be serving the economy instead of right. The economy making life easier for mothers. When we do that, we're doing nothing but mirroring the communist nations.
Yep, just different words, but the same view of children and human life. Mary Sock, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony.
All right, on the other side of the break, early academic education for children. Is it a good thing? The president wants to make it available for everybody, mandatory in some cases, across the country. Is it a good thing? We're going to talk about it next on the other side of the break. Don't go away. We'll be back with more Washington Watch in just a moment.
Do you want to be able to stay up to date on conservative news? Are you looking for Christian resources to help you stay politically engaged? Then download Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. With all of our content available at your fingertips, you will conveniently be able to stay up to date throughout your busy day. The Stand Firm app will give you access to a variety of resources, such as our most recent episodes of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, tweets and other social media posts, and our latest blogs, updates, and publications. Additionally, you will have the opportunity to take action and make your voice heard by contacting your elected officials on the issues that most concern you. Visit the App Store on your smartphone or mobile device and search Stand Firm to download Family Research Council's official Stand Firm app.
What is religious liberty and why should you care about it? Simply put, religious liberty is the freedom to choose your religious beliefs and to live according to those beliefs. Why should we care about this freedom? At Family Research Council, we care about religious freedom because we believe that it is an inherent human right that all governments have an obligation to protect. Tragically, not all governments do. Religious persecution is a tragic reality around the world that is not often acknowledged by the media, even though attacks on people of all faiths continue to increase globally. In Scripture, God calls Christians to pray and care for the persecuted church, the downtrodden, and those who cannot help themselves. Therefore, we must be advocates for those persecuted for their faith. To access Family Research Council's latest resources and to learn more about religious freedom and what you can do to help the persecuted, go to frc.org/religious liberty.
Attention university students! Are you looking for an internship that will help you grow as a Christian leader and allow you to positively influence the culture? Then Family Research Council's internship program is for you. FRC's life-changing 12 to 15-week internship program will prepare and equip you for the next step in your professional journey. You'll enjoy a speaker series focusing on careers and callings, lectures from prominent conservative leaders, and weekly biblical worldview training. All of these offerings were created to aid you in your personal and professional development. As an intern, you will have the opportunity to work side by side with our experts in policy, communications, event planning, and more. The real-world experience you gain will prepare you to pursue a career of influence and make a difference wherever God calls you. This paid internship offers fully funded housing in the heart of downtown DC, giving you the chance to experience our nation's capital. Visit frc.org/internships to apply.
You're listening to Washington Watch, and I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, tonyperkins.com. Late last April, in his first speech to a joint session of Congress, President Biden officially announced his $1.8 trillion American Families Plan, which, among other things, would add four more years of free public education to the universal schooling for K through 12 students.
12 years is no longer enough today to compete with the rest of the world in the 21st century. That's why my American Families Plan guarantees four additional years of public education for every person in America, starting as early as we can.
Is public education at earlier ages really what America needs? Now, let's put the indoctrination that we've been talking about aside for a moment. Let's talk about if the schools were just teaching the basics, is it the best thing for America's kids? Well, the answer to that question is no. According to a newly reported study, it's the first well-controlled long-term study that has ever been conducted of a statewide publicly supported preschool program. I mean, the credentials of the teachers were impeccable. The curriculum had been reviewed. This was the perfect scenario to give kids, quote unquote, a head start. Well, here to talk about this is Dr. Catherine Stevens. She's the founder and CEO of the Center on Child and Family Policy, which aims to advance the well-being of young children and their families through conducting rigorous research, providing evidence-based analysis, and fostering a more robust competition of ideas in early childhood policy. Dr. Stevens, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, I doubt that you were surprised by this, but this study out of Tennessee is pretty remarkable as it lays out the case that what the government is pursuing doesn't work.
Well, in one way, people find this study surprising because its results are not the same as a lot of other research because this was a much more rigorous study. However, the findings of this study are consistent with what we would expect given what we know about early human development, which is that a school environment, a group institutional setting, is not optimal for early childhood development.
You know, we hear a lot about following the evidence, the science, and the social science, pretty clear. In fact, interesting that Germany, that did studies on this back in the 70s, rejected this idea of early childhood education. But again, this is a pretty broad study, and you're right. You're absolutely right. This builds upon previous studies that have been done. But in this study, coming out of Vanderbilt, what I find fascinating about this is a pretty big study. I mean, 3,000 children were involved in the study. It looked at them over an extended period of time. And the bottom line, well, I'm going to let you tell our viewers and our listeners what the bottom line of the findings of this exhaustive study were.
So the bottom line of the findings is that right after these researchers compared two groups of children. One group was admitted to pre-K, but there weren't enough spaces for all the kids. So there were about a little over half the kids got into pre-K. The other kids had parents who had wanted to get them into pre-K. However, there were not enough spaces. So the researchers used this to compare these two groups of children, all of whom had parents who were trying to get them into pre-K. One group went to pre-K, the other group did not go to pre-K. What they found was that at the beginning of kindergarten, the children who had gone to pre-K had slightly stronger skills. They knew a few more letters, a few more numbers. However, what's really valuable about this study is it's a controlled study in the way that I just described, which is kind of the gold standard of research and not done much in early childhood. And these researchers have been following the children, the pre-K group and the not pre-K group, now up through sixth grade. What they found by third grade is that the children who had attended pre-K were doing slightly worse on achievement, like math and reading achievement tests. What concerned the researchers at the third grade point was that they were seeing some evidence of behavior issues with the pre-K group that they didn't see in the non-pre-K group. The report that's just come out is reporting after sixth grade. And what they found was that still the children who attended pre-K are doing a little worse in terms of basic academic skills. However, they're doing a lot worse. The pre-K group, the kids who went to pre-K are doing a lot worse than the kids who did not in terms of discipline issues, behavior issues. The problems that the pre-K group is having have gotten worse since third grade. So the longer they've been in school, the worse these problems have become. So what this tells us is that attending pre-K did not help them in their elementary school experience. As a matter of fact, it seems to have hurt them.
So it's like it gave them an initial boost of energy, but it quickly ran out and they fell behind their peers. Now, you're going back to the design of this study. I mean, it is a randomized controlled experiment, two groups. So, you know, for those, and these are coming from lower income groups. So it's all the same. So, I mean, these everything, when you look at everything, it is a level playing field. So you can't say, well, they're doing bad because they had this or they didn't have this. I mean, we're looking at this and you see this gap expanding over time. I'm curious, are they going to continue to look beyond the sixth grade to whether or not we go to the 12th grade to see if these kids make it all the way through, if they have additional behavior issues? Are they going to continue the study?
I think so. As I understand it, the Tennessee state legislature authorized additional funding for the study several years ago as they were seeing these really valuable results. Another thing that you'll hear is often if you're just reading the newspaper, there is frequently said that a large body of research shows that pre-K, quote, works. But along the lines of what you were just explaining, the difference with this study, and there's only one other study that's been done like this, is you're comparing apples to apples. So as you said, it's just an absolute level playing field. The way these studies are usually done is they take a large group of kids in high school, say, and they see how each group's doing. And then they find out, had those children gone to pre-K? So some kids had gone to pre-K, some kids had not gone to pre-K. However, that's not apples to apples because pre-K is voluntary. So what that means is if the children who had gone to pre-K, what that tells us is they had parents
right.
who made a big effort to get them into pre-K, right?
Right.
And
right.
So the outcomes that are reported and attributed to pre-K are actually, it's much more logical that those outcomes are actually telling us something about parents. So
right.
in other words, attending pre-K doesn't cause those outcomes. It may predict them because it shows that this family is particularly interested in education, particularly engaged with their child's education, which research has shown is the number one factor in children's academic success.
Yeah, don't get me started on that, Dr. Stevens, because we're seeing now educational establishment not wanting parents involved, when in fact we have abundance of research that says that's a determining factor in the success of a child. But that's a rabbit. I'm not going to chase that today. I'm going to go back to the outcomes. You know, you mentioned the issue of the gap in learning, behavioral issues, but there's also this report of learning disorders, that we're seeing more learning disorders among those that were in the pre-K program. Now, a lot of these things we don't know the exact reason for. A lot of it's speculation, but some suggest it could in part be because of labels that we put on kids as they make their way through the process. Can you talk to that?
Yes. So I guess it's probably not correct to say that they have more learning disorders. We don't know what they have or don't have. What they have is more, as you've just suggested, diagnoses of learning disorders. And research has suggested that children getting a diagnosis is actually detrimental, not always, but in a lot of cases.
Let me give you a scenario. Mm-hmm. So you're taking these kids and you're corralling them in a classroom, these young kids who need to be outside playing, throwing sticks and climbing up walls and doing things that kids do to get that energy out and to explore and to learn and to develop their skills. So you're confining them into a room and they don't like to sit still. And they're not really responsive to a teacher. And so you put a label on them as being, ADD or whatever. And that begins to be a shaping label upon that child, does it not?
Yes, yes. And plus there's just more time in school for teachers to diagnose them, right? I used to work in K-12, Tony, and I observed that when teachers were not good at their job, they were not able to teach. Some, not all, but some went to great lengths to establish that it's not their fault, it's the fault of the kid. And that is where, in some cases, that's where these diagnoses come in, is a teacher is having a trouble, just exactly as you said, partly because the child is not in a developmentally appropriate environment. And perhaps also the teacher is just not good, right? And teachers, when you give a child a diagnosis, they are often taken out of your classroom, either altogether or for long periods of time, so you don't have to deal with them. So it is that's the fact that they have more, they have been diagnosed with more learning disabilities does not appear to be a good sign. It's going to be very interesting, as you've said, to see as they're followed forward how that plays out when they're older.
I'm just thankful that when I was a kid in school that they didn't have all those labels, because my school file was not big enough to contain all of the labels they would have put on me. You know, look, it's the reality of creative kids. You know, I was joking the other day, I get paid for what I used to get sent to the hall for today. You know, we have to let the individual child develop. And that's a part of the problem with public education in particular, is that we put all of the kids into a single mold. And moving it even to a younger age, where these kids do not have an opportunity to develop their own personality, their own style, we're putting them into this mold at the earliest of ages. And I think this is extremely alarming, to the effect that this have not only on the kids, but I think on the creative nature of America that has made our economy work and has made us a successful nation, that all of a sudden we're producing these educational clones by putting these kids in these academic settings so early in life.
Yeah, well, there's nothing in developmental science that suggests that putting 4-year-olds or 3-year-olds or even younger children in group institutional settings is what they need to develop well. It's just not what developmental science tells us. You know, my theory on this is as follows. We, up until the mid-1960s, the public schools were a building that kids went to learn basic skills, as they used to say, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It was a very discrete particular thing that the schools did. During the War on Poverty, it was actually Lyndon Johnson was the first to suggest that the public schools would be the vehicle for upward mobility in our society, that public schools would solve poverty. That was not something that we thought in America before the 1960s. Since the 1960s, we have come to equate human development with schooling. We never used to think that. For all of human history, we never equated human development with schooling. That has become such a binding way of thinking. We don't even realize we're thinking it anymore. Mm-hmm. Obviously, spending on the schools has gone up and up and up. As we are now understanding, for very good reasons, how absolutely crucial early childhood is, we're understanding that early development is very important. Because we're used to thinking of school, when we're now focused on early childhood, we think early school.
Right.
So we are confusing early development with early school.
And the outcome of that could be disastrous for the children and for the nation. Dr. Stevens, I hate to say it, but we're out of time. I've enjoyed our conversation. We'll have it. We'll have you back on, and we'll talk more about it. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'd be delighted. Thank you very much.
And folks, thank you for being with us as well. And until next time, I leave you with the words of the Apostle Paul. He says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.